Chapter 38. In mid-July, Uncle Dan took Lucette to Kaluga, where she was to stay, with Bell and French, for 5 days. The Liaskin Ballet and a German circus were in town, and no child would want to miss the schoolgirls' field hockey and swimming matches, which old Dan, a child at heart, attended religiously at that time of year. Moreover, she had to undergo a series of tests at the Taurus Hospital to settle what caused her weight and temperature to fluctuate so abnormally, despite her eating so heartily and feeling so well. On the Friday afternoon when her father planned to return with her, he also expected to bring a Kaluga lawyer to Ardis, where Damon was to come too, an unusual occurrence. The business to be discussed was the sale of some blue peat bog land, which belonged to both cousins, and which both, for different reasons, were anxious to get rid of. As usually happened with Dan's most carefully worked out plans, something misfired. The lawyer could not promise to come till late in the evening, and just before Damon arrived, his cousin aerogrammed a message asking Marina to dine Damon without waiting for Dan and Miller. That contretemps, Marina's humorous term for a not necessarily nasty surprise, greatly pleased Vaughn. He had seen little of his father that year. He loved him with light-hearted devotion, had worshipped him in boyhood, and respected him staunchly now in his tolerant but better-informed youth. Still later, a tinge of repulsion, the same repulsion he felt in regard to his own immorality, became admixed to the love and the esteem. But, on the other hand, the older he grew, the more firmly he felt that he would give his life for his father, at a moment's notice, with pride and pleasure, in any circumstance imaginable. When Marina, in the late 1890s, in her miserable dotage, used to ramble on, with embarrassing and disgusting details about dead Damon's crimes, he felt pity for him and her. But his indifference to Marina and his adoration for his father remained unchanged. To endure thus even now, in the chronologically hardly believable 1960s. No accursed generalizer, with a halfpenny mind and a dry fig heart, would be able to explain, and this is my sweetest revenge for all the detractions my life work has met with, the individual vagaries evolved in those and similar matters. No art and no genius would exist without such vagaries, and this is a final pronouncement, damning all clowns and clods. When had Damon visited Ardis in recent years? April 23, 1884, the day Vaughn's first summer stay there had been suggested, planned, promised. Twice in the summer of 1885, while Vaughn was climbing mountains in the western states and the Veen girls were in Europe. A dinner in 1886 in June or July. Where was Vaughn? In 1887 for a few days in May, Ada was botanizing with a German woman in Nestotia or California. Vaughn was whoring in Chose. Taking advantage of La Riviere's and Lucette's absence, Vaughn had long dallied with Ada in the comfortable nursery and was now hanging from the wrong window, which did not give a clear view of the drive, when he heard the rich purr of his father's motor car. He dashed downstairs, the speed of his descent causing the heat of the banisters to burn the palm of his hand in a merry way, remindful of similar occasions in his boyhood. There was nobody in the hall. Damon had entered the house from a side gallery and was now settled in the sun-dusted music room, wiping his monocle with a special zamshinka, chamois, as he awaited his pre-brandial brandy, an ancient quip. His hair was dyed a raven black, his teeth were hound white. His smooth, glossy brown face with its trimly clipped black mustache and humid dark eyes beamed at his son, expressing the radiant love which Vaughn reciprocated and which both vainly tried to camouflage with habitual pleasantry.
Hello, Dad.
Oh.
Hello, Vaughn.
Tres American. Schoolyard. There he slams the car door. There he comes through the snow. Always gloves, no overcoat ever.
Want to go to the bathroom, Father?
My land, sweet land.
Do you want to go to the bathroom? asked Vaughn with a twinkle.
No, thanks. I had my bath this morning.
Quick sigh, acknowledging the passage of time, he, too, remembered every detail of those father and son dinners at River Lane, the immediate dutiful offer of the W.C., the hearty masters, the ignoble meal, creamed hash, God save America, embarrassed sons, vulgar fathers, titled Britisher and Greek grandee matching yachts and yaks and York Fest in the Bahamutas. May I transfer inconspicuously this delicious pink-frosted synthesis from my plate to yours, son?
You don't like it, Dad?
Acting horribly hurt. God save their poor little American taste buds.
Your new car sounds wonderful, said Vaughn.
Doesn't it?
Yes.
Ask Vaughn about that gornichon, Franco-Russian slang of the meanest grade for a cute kamaristechka.
And how is everything, my dear boy?
I saw you last the day you returned from Cho's. We waste life in separations. We are the fools of fate. Oh, let's spend a month together in Paris or London before the Michaelmas term.
Demand shed his monocle and wiped his eyes with the modish lace-frilled handkerchief that lodged in the heart pocket of his dinner jacket. His tear glands were facile in action when no real sorrow made him control himself.
You look quite satanically fit, Dad, especially with that fresh oye and your lapel eye. I suppose you have not been much in Manhattan lately. Where did you get its last syllable?
Homespun pun in the Venish vein.
I offered myself, en effet, a trip to Acapulco,
answered Demon, needlessly and unwillingly recollecting, with that special concussion of instant detail that also plagued his children, a violet and black striped fish in a bowl, a similarly striped couch, the subtropical sun bringing out the veins of an onyx ashtray astray on the stone floor, a batch of old, orange-juice-stained Pavesia Playboy magazines, the jewels he had brought, the phonograph singing in a dreamy girl's voice, Petit Nègre aux Champs qui fleurent, and the admirable abdomen of a very expensive and very faithless and altogether adorable young Creole.
Did what's her name go with you?
Well, my boy, frankly, the nomenclature is getting more and more confused every year. Let us speak of plainer things. Where are the drinks? They were promised me by a passing angel.
Passing angel? Vaughn pulled a green bell cord, which sent a melodious message pantryward, and caused the old-fashioned, bronze-framed little aquarium, with its lone convict cichlid, to bubble antiphonally in a corner of the music room, an eerie, perhaps self-aerating reaction which only Kim Beauharnais, the kitchen boy, understood.
Should he ring her up after dinner? Wondered Demon. What time would it be there?
Not much use. Bad for the heart.
I don't know if you know, said Vaughn, resuming his perch on the fat arm of his father's chair. Uncle Dan will be here with the lawyer and Lucette only after dinner.
Capital, said Demon.
Marina and Ada should be down in a minute. Ce sera un dîner à quatre.
Capital, he repeated. You look splendid, my dear, dear fellow. And I don't have to exaggerate compliments as some do in regard to an aging man with shoe-shined hair. Your dinner jacket is very nice. Or rather, it's very nice recognizing one's old tailor in one's son's clothes. Like catching oneself repeating an ancestral mannerism. For example, this, wagging his left forefinger three times at the height of his temple, which my mother did in casual Pacific denial. That gene missed you. But I've seen it in my hairdresser's looking glass when refusing to have him put Kremlin on my bald spot. And you know who had it, too? My Aunt Kitty, who married the banker Bolensky after divorcing that dreadful old wencher Lyovka Tolstoy, the writer. Demon preferred Walter Scott to Dickens and did not think highly of Russian novelists. As usual, Vaughn considered it fit to make a corrective comment.
A fantastically artistic writer, Dad.
You are a fantastically charming boy,
said Demon, shedding another sweet water tear. He pressed to his cheek Van's strong, shapely hand. Van kissed his father's hairy fist, which was already holding a not yet visible glass of liquor. Despite the manly impact of their Irishness, all Veens who had Russian blood revealed much tenderness in ritual overflows of affection, while remaining somewhat inept in its verbal expression.
"I say," exclaimed Demon, "what's happened? Your shaftment is that of a carpenter's. Show me your other hand." "Good gracious,"
muttering, "hump of Venus disfigured, line of life scarred but monstrously long." Switching to a gypsy chant,
"You'll live to reach Terra and come back a wiser and merrier man."
Reverting to his ordinary voice,
"What puzzles me as a palmist is the strange condition of the sister of your life, and the roughness."
"Masco de Gama," whispered Vaughn, raising his eyebrows.
"Ah, of course! How blunt, dumb of me. Now tell me, you like Ardis Hall?"
"I adore it," said Vaughn. "It's for me the Chateau que Bagnier l'adore. I would gladly spend all my scarred and strange life here, but that's a hopeless fancy."
"Hopeless? I wonder. I know Dan wants to leave it to Lucille, but Dan is greedy, and my affairs are such that I can satisfy great greed. When I was your age, I thought that the sweetest word in the language rhymes with billiard, and now I know I was right. If you're really keen, son, on having this property, I might try to buy it. I can exert a certain pressure upon my Marina. She sighs like a hassock when you sit upon her, so to speak. Damn it, the servants here are not Mercury's. Pull that cord again."
"Yes, maybe Dan could be made to sell."
"That's very black of you, Dad," said pleased Vaughn, using a slang phrase he had learned from his tender young nurse, Ruby, who was born in the Mississippi region, where most magistrates, public benefactors, high priests of various so-called denominations, and other honorable and generous men had the dark or darkish skin of their West African ancestors, who had been the first navigators to reach the Gulf of Mexico.
"I wonder," Demon mused.
"It would cost hardly more than a couple of millions minus what Cousin Dan owes me, minus also the Lador pastures, which are utterly mucked up and should be got rid of gradually, if the local squires don't blow up that new kerosene distillery, the Stid Isram, shame of our county. I'm not particularly fond of Ardis, but I have nothing against it, though I detest its environs. Lador town has become very honky-tonky, and the gaming is not what it used to be. You have all sorts of rather odd neighbors. Poor Lord Erminen is practically insane. At the races the other day, I was talking to a woman I preyed upon years ago. Oh, long before Moses de Vere cuckolded at her husband in my absence and shot him dead in my presence. An epigram you've heard before, no doubt, from these very lips.
The next thing will be paternal repetitiousness.
But a good son should put up with a little paternal repetitiousness. Well, she tells me her boy and Ada see a lot of each other, etc.
Is that true?
Not really, said Vaughn. They meet now and then, at the usual parties. Both like horses and races, but that's all. There is no etc. That's out of the question.
Good. Ah, the portentous footfall is approaching, I hear. Praskovy de Pre has the worst fault of a snob, overstatement. Bonsoir, Boutéen. You look as ruddy as your native vine. But we are not getting any younger, as the Emmerlocks say, and that pretty messenger of mine must have been waylaid by some younger and more fortunate suitor. Prashu, Papachka.
Please, Dad, murmured Vaughn,
who always feared that his father's recondite jests might offend a menial, while sinning himself by being sometimes too curt. But, to use a hoary narrational turn, The old Frenchman knew his former master too well to be bothered by gentlemanly humor. His hand still tingled nicely from slapping Blanche's compact young bottom for having garbled Mr. Veen's simple request and broken a flower vase. After placing his tray on a low table, he retreated a few steps, his fingers remaining curved in the tray-carrying position, and only then acknowledged Demand's welcome with a fond bow. Was Monsieur's health always good? Indeed it was.
"I want," said Demand, "a bottle of your Chateau Latour d'Estoc for dinner."
And when the butler, having removed, en passant, a crumpled little handkerchief from the piano top, had left the room with another salute,
"How do you get along with Ada? She's, what, almost 16 now? Very musical and romantic?"
"We are close friends," said Vaughn, who had carefully prepared his answer to a question he had expected to come in one form or another. "We have really more things in common than, for instance, ordinary lovers or cousins or siblings. I mean, we are really inseparable. We read a lot. She is spectacularly self-educated, thanks to her granddad's library. She knows the names of all the flowers and finches in the neighborhood. She is altogether a very amusing girl."
"Vaughn," began Demand, but stopped.
As he had begun and stopped a number of times before in the course of the last years, someday it would have to be said, but this was not the right moment. He inserted his monocle and examined the bottles.
"By the way, son, do you crave any of these aperitifs? My father allowed me Lilitovka and that Illinois brat, awful bilge, entre nous svadia, as Marina would say. I suspect your uncle has a cache behind the Solanders in his study and keeps there a finer whiskey than this usque ad ruscum. Well, let us have the cognac as planned, unless you are a filius aquae.
No pun intended, but one gets carried away and goofs."
"Oh, I prefer claret. I'll concentrate, nalagu, on the Latour later on. No, I'm certainly no teetotaler. And besides, the artist's tap water is not recommended."
"I must warn Marina," said Demand after a gum rinse and a slow swallow, "that her husband should stop swilling tittery and stick to French and Califrench wines, after that little stroke he had. I met him in town recently, near Mad Avenue, saw him walking toward me quite normally, but then as he caught sight of me, a block away, the clockwork began slowing down and he stopped, oh, helplessly, before he reached me. That's hardly normal. Okay, let our sweethearts never meet, as we used to say, up at Cho's. Only Yukonians think cognac is bad for the liver because they have nothing but vodka. Well, I'm glad you get along so well with Ada. That's fine. A moment ago in that gallery, I ran into a remarkably pretty soubrette. She never once raised her lashes and answered in French when I... Please, my boy, move that screen a little. That's right. The stab of a sunset, especially from under a thunderhead, is not for my poor eyes. Or poor ventricles. Do you like the type, Van? The bowed little head, the bare neck, the high heels, the trot, the wiggle? You do, don't you? Well, sir, tell him I'm the youngest Venusian. Does he belong too? Show the sign? Better not. Invent. Well, I'm resting after my torrid affair in London with my tango partner, whom you saw me dance with when you flew over for that last show. Remember?
Indeed I do.
Curious, you calling it that.
I think, sir, you've had enough brandy.
Sure, sure, said Demand, wrestling with a subtle question which only the ineptitude of a kindred conjecture had crowded out of Marina's mind, granted it could have entered by some back door, for ineptitude is always synonymous with multitude, and nothing is fuller than an empty mind.
Naturally, continued Demand, there is a good deal to be said for a restful summer in the country.
Open-air life and all that, said Vaughn.
It is incredible that a young boy should control his father's liquor intake, remarked Demon, pouring himself a fourth shallow. On the other hand, he went on, nursing the thin-stemmed, gold-rimmed cup, open-air life may be pretty bleak without a summer romance, and not many decent girls haunt the neighborhood, I agree. There was that lovely Ermenin girl,
une petite juive très aristocratique, but I understand she's engaged. By the way, the Dupre woman tells me her son has enlisted and will soon be taking part in that deplorable business abroad, which our country should have ignored. I wonder if he leaves any rivals behind.
Goodness, no, replied Honest Van. Anna is a serious young lady. She has no beau. Except me, Savassien Dieu.
Now, who? Who, Dad? Who said that for sans dire?
Oh, King Wing. When I wanted to know how he liked his French wife.
Well, that's fine news about Ada.
She likes horses, you say?
She likes, said Vaughn, what all our belles like. Balls, orchids, and the cherry orchard. Here, Ada herself came running into the room.
Yes, 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 here I come, beaming.
Old Demon, iridescent wings humped, half rose but sank back again, enveloping Ada with one arm, holding his glass in the other hand, kissing the girl in the neck, in the hair, burrowing in her sweetness with more than an uncle's fervor.
Gosh, she exclaimed,
with an outbreak of nursery slang that affected Vaughn with even more humilenie attendrissement, melting ravishment, than his father seemed to experience.
How lovely to see you, clawing your way through the clouds, swooping down on Tamara's castle,
Lermontov paraphrased by Loudon.
The last time I enjoyed you, said Demon, was in April, when you wore a raincoat with a white and black scarf and simply reeked of some arsenic stuff after seeing your dentist. Dr. Perlman has married his receptionist, you'll be glad to know. Now to business, my darling. I accept your dress, the sleeveless black sheath. I tolerate your romantic hairdo. I don't care much for your pumps, Nabosu Nogu, on bare feet, your beau mask perfume, pas encore. But, my precious, I abhor and reject your livid lipstick. It may be the fashion in good old Lodore. It is not done in Man or London.
Ladno.
Okay, said Ada, and baring her big teeth, fiercely rubbed her lips with a tiny handkerchief produced from her bosom.
That's also provincial. You should carry a black silk purse. And now I'll show you what a diviner I am. Your dream is to be a concert pianist.
It is not, said Vaughn indignantly. What perfect nonsense. She can't play a note.
This is the end of disc number 7. Please insert disc number 8.
That's also provincial. You should carry a black silk purse. And now I'll show you what a diviner I am. Your dream is to be a concert pianist.
It is not, said Vaughn indignantly. What perfect nonsense. She can't play a note.
Well, no matter, said Demon. Observation is not always the mother of deduction. However, there is nothing improper about a hanky dumped on a Bechstein. You don't have, my love, to blush so warmly. Let me quote, for comic relief, Lorsque son fiancé fut parti pour la guerre, Irène est grand fief, le pauvre et noble enfant, ferma son piano, vendit son éléphant. The gobble enfant is genuine, but the éléphant is mine.
You don't say so, laughed Ada.
Our great Coppée, said Vaughn,
is awful, of course, yet he has one very fetching little piece which Ada de Grand Fief here has twisted into English several times, more or less successfully.
Oh, Van, interjected Ada with unusual archness and scooped up a handful of salted almonds.
Let's hear it, let's hear it, cried Damon as he borrowed a nut from her cupped hand.
The neat interplay of harmonious motions, the candid gaiety of family reunions, the never-entangling marionette strings, all this is easier described than imagined.
Old storytelling devices, said Vaughn, may be parodied only by very great and inhuman artists, but only close relatives can be forgiven for paraphrasing illustrious poems. Let me preface the effort of a cousin, anybody's cousin, by a snatch of Pushkin for the sake of rhyme.
For the snake of rhyme, cried Ada. A paraphrase, even my paraphrase, is like the corruption of snake root into snaggrel. All that remains of a delicate little birthwort.
Which is amply sufficient, said Damon, for my little needs and those of my little friends.
So here goes, continued Vaughn, ignoring what he felt was an indecent illusion, since the unfortunate plant used to be considered by the ancient inhabitants of the Lodore region not so much as a remedy for the bite of a reptile, as the token of a very young woman's easy delivery. But no matter. By chance preserved has been the poem. In fact, I have it. Here it is. Le chit est lent, and one can know 'em.
Oh, I know 'em, interrupted Damon.
Le chute est lent, un peu le suivre. Du regard en reconnaissant. Le chien a sa feuille de cuivre, l'érable a sa feuille de sang.
Grand stuff.
Yes, that was Copay, and now comes the cousin, said Vaughn, and he recited,
Their fall is gentle, the leaves dropper can follow each of them and know the oak tree by its leaf of copper, the maple by its blood-red glow.
Ha! Uttered the versionist.
Not at all, cried Damon. That leaves-dropper is a splendid trouvaille, girl.
He pulled the girl to him, she landing on the arm of his Klubsessel, and he glued himself with thick, moist lips to her hot red ear through the rich black strands. Vaughn felt a shiver of delight.
It was now Marina's turn to make her entree, which she did in excellent chiaroscuro circumstances, wearing a spangled dress, her face in the soft focus sought by ripe stars, holding out both arms and followed by Jones, who carried two flambeaux and kept trying to keep within the limits of decorum the odd little go-away kicks he was aiming backwards at a brown flurry in the shadows.
Marina!
Cried Damon with perfunctory enthusiasm, and patted her hand as he joined her on a settee. Puffing rhythmically, Jones set one of his beautiful dragon-entwined flambeaux on the lowboy with the gleaming drinks, and was about to bring over its fellow to the spot where Damon and Marina were winding up affable preliminaries, but was quickly motioned by Marina to a pedestal near the striped fish. Puffing, he drew the curtains, for nothing but picturesque ruins remained of the day. Jones was new, very efficient, solemn, and slow, and one had to get used gradually to his ways and wheeze. Years later, he rendered me a service that I will never forget.
She's a jeune fille fatale, a pale, heartbreaking beauty,
Damon confided to his former mistress, without bothering to discover whether the subject of his praise could hear him. She did. From the other end of the room where she was helping Vaughn to corner the dog and showing too much leg in the process. Our old friend, being quite as excited as the rest of the reunited family, had scampered in after Marina with an old miniver-furred slipper in his merry mouth. The slipper belonged to Blanche, who had been told to whisk Dak back to her room, but as usual had not incarcerated him properly. Both children experienced a chill of déjà vu, a twofold déjà vu, in fact, when contemplated in artistic retrospect.
Pozhialtse bez glupostia.
Please, no silly things,
especially devant les gens," said deeply flattered Marina, sounding the final S as her grand dames had done. And when the slow, fish-mouthed footman had gone carrying away supine, high-chested Dac and his poor plaything, she continued, "Really, in comparison to the local girls, to Grace Erminen, for example, or Cordula de Pré, Ada is a Turgovenian maiden or even a Jane Austen miss. I'm Fanny Price, actually," commented Ada.
"In the staircase scene," added Vaughn.
"Let's not bother about their private jokes," said Marina to Damon. "I never can understand their games and little secrets. Mademoiselle La Riviere, however, has written a wonderful screenplay about mysterious children doing strange things in old parks. But don't let her start talking of her literary successes tonight. That would be fatal."
"I hope your husband won't be too late," said Damon. "He is not at his best after 8 p.m. Summertime, you know.
By the way, how's Lucette?"
At this moment, both battens of the door were flung open by Boutillon in the grand manner, and Dumas offered kalachnikom, in the form of a Russian crescent loaf, his arm to Marina. Vaughn, who in his father's presence was prone to lapse into a rather dismal sort of playfulness, proposed taking Ada in, but she slapped his wrist away with a sisterly sans gêne, of which Fanny Price might not have approved. Another Price, a typical, too typical old retainer, whom Marina and G.A. Vronsky, during their brief romance, had dubbed for unknown reasons Grib, placed an onyx ashtray at the head of the table for Damon, who liked to smoke between courses, a puff of Russian ancestry. A side table supported also, in the Russian fashion, a collection of red, black, gray, beige, hors d'oeuvre, with the serviette caviar, Sofyatochnaya ikra, separated from the pot of graybead, ikra svezhyaya, by the succulent pomp of preserved bolets, white and subbutyline, while the pink of smoked salmon vied with the incarnadine of Westphalian ham. The variously flavored vodochki glittered on a separate tray. The French cuisine had contributed chaud froid and foie gras. A window was open, and the crickets were stridulating at an ominous speed in the black, motionless foliage. It was, to continue the novelistic structure, a long, joyful, delicious dinner, and although the talk consisted mainly of family quips and bright banalities, that reunion was to remain suspended in one's memory as a strangely significant, not wholly pleasant, experience. One treasured it in the same way as when falling in love with a picture in a pinoteca, or remembering a dream style, the dream detail, the meaningful richness of color and contour in an otherwise meaningless vision. It should be observed that nobody, not even the reader, not even Boutillon, who crumbled, alas, a precious cork, was at his or her best at that particular party. A faint element of farce and falsity flawed it, preventing an angel, if angels could visit artists, from being completely at ease. And yet it was a marvelous show, which no artist would have wanted to miss. The tablecloth and the candle blaze attracted timorous or impetuous moths, among which Ada, with a ghost pointing them out to her, could not help recognizing many old flutter friends. Pale intruders, anxious only to spread out their delicate wings on some lustrous surface, ceiling bumpers in guildman furs, thick-set rake-hells with bushy antennae, and party-crashing hawk moths with red, black-belted bellies, sailed or shot, silent or humming, into the dining room out of the black, hot, humid night. It was a black, hot, humid night in mid-July, 1888, at Ardis in Lodore County, let us not forget, let us never forget, with a family of four seated around an oval dinner table bright with flowers and crystal. Not a scene in a play, as might have seemed, nay, must have seemed, to a spectator, with a camera or a program placed in the velvet pit of the garden. 16 years had elapsed from the end of Marina's 3-year affair with Dimon. Intermissions of various length, a break of 2 months in the spring of 1870, another of almost 4 in the middle of 1871, had, at the time, only increased the tenderness and the torture. Her singularly coarsened features, her attire, that sequin-spangled dress, the glittering net over her strawberry-blonde dyed hair, her red, sunburnt chest and melodramatic makeup, with too much ochre and maroon in it, did not even vaguely remind the man, who had loved her more keenly than any other woman in his philanderings, of the dash, the glamour, the lyricism of Marina Dermanov's beauty. It aggrieved him, that complete collapse of the past, the dispersal of its itinerant court and music makers, the logical impossibility to relate the dubious reality of the present to the unquestionable one of remembrance. Even these hors d'oeuvres on the Zakushchny stole of Ardis Manor and its painted dining room did not link up with their petit souper, although, God knows, the triple staple to start with was always much the same, pickled young bolettes in their tight-fitting glossy fawn helmets, the gray beads of fresh caviar, the goose liver paste, picased with Perigord truffles. Dimon popped into his mouth a last morsel of black bread with elastic samlet, gulped down a last pony of vodka, and took his place at the table with Marina facing him across its oblong length, beyond the great bronze bowl with carved-looking Calville apples and elongated Persty grapes. The alcohol his vigorous system had already imbibed was instrumental, as usual, in reopening what he gallistically called condemned doors. And now, as he gaped involuntarily, as all men do while spreading a napkin, he considered Marina's pretentious ciel étoilé hairdress and tried to realize, in the rare full sense of the word, tried to possess the reality of a fact by forcing it into the sensuous center, that here was a woman whom he had intolerably loved, who had loved him hysterically and skittishly, who insisted they make love on rugs and cushions laid on the floor, as respectable people do in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, who would whoosh down fluffy slopes on a bobsleigh a fortnight after parturation, or arrive by the Orient Express with 5 trunks, Dak's grandsire, and a maid, to Dr. Stella Ospensko's Ospedale, where he was recovering from a scratch received in a sword duel, and still visible as a white wheel under his 8th rib after a lapse of nearly 17 years. How strange that when one met, after a long separation, a chum or fat aunt whom one had been fond of as a child, the unimpaired human warmth of the friendship was rediscovered at once. But with an old mistress, this never happened. The human part of one's affection seemed to be swept away with the dust of the inhuman passion in a wholesale operation of demolishment. He looked at her and acknowledged the perfection of the pottage. But she, this rather thick-set woman, good-hearted, no doubt, but restive and sour-faced, glazed over, nose, forehead, and all, with a sort of brownish oil that she considered to be more juvenizing than powder, was more of a stranger to him than Bouteillon, who had once carried her in his arms in a feigned faint out of a Lador villa and into a cab after a final, quite final, row on the eve of her wedding. Marina, essentially a dummy in human disguise, experienced no such qualms, lacking as she did that third sight, individual, magically detailed imagination, which many otherwise ordinary and conformant people may also possess, but without which memory, even that of a profound thinker or technician of genius, is, let's face it, a stereotype or a tear sheet. We do not wish to be too hard on Marina, after all. Her blood throbs in our wrists and temples, and many of our megrims are hers, not his. Yet we cannot condone the grossness of her soul. The man sitting at the head of the table and joined to her by a pair of cheerful youngsters, the juvenile, in movie parlance, on her right, the ingenue on her left, differed in no way from the same Damon in much the same black jacket, minus perhaps the carnation he had evidently purloined from a vase Blanche had been told to bring from the gallery, who sat next to her at the Praslins last Christmas. The dizzy chasm he felt every time he met her, that awful wonder of life with its extravagant jumble of geological faults, could not be bridged by what she accepted as a dotted line of humdrum encounters. Poor old Damon, all her pillowmates being retired with that title, appeared before her like a harmless ghost in the foyers of theaters between mirror and fan, or in the drawing rooms of common friends, or once in Lincoln Park, indicating an indigo-buttocked ape with his cane and not saluting her, according to the rules of the beau monde, because he was with a courtesan. Somewhere further back, much further back, safely transformed by her screen-corrupted mind into a stale melodrama, was her three-year-long period of hectically spaced love meetings with Damon. A Torrid Affair, the title of her only cinema hit, passion in palaces, the palms and larches, his utter devotion, his impossible temper, separations, reconciliations, blue trains, tears, treachery, terror, an insane sister's threats, helpless no doubt, but leaving their tiger marks on the drapery of dreams, especially when dampness and dark affect one with fever, and the shadow of retribution on the back wall, with ridiculous legal innuendos. All this was mere scenery, easily packed, labeled hell, and freighted away. And only very infrequently some reminder would come, say in the trickwork close-up of two left hands belonging to different sexes, doing what? Marina could no longer recall, though only 4 years had elapsed, playing a quatre mains. No, neither took piano lessons, casting bunny shadows on a wall. Closer, warmer, but still wrong. Measuring something? But what? Climbing a tree? The polished trunk of a tree? But where? When? Someday, she mused, one's past must be put in order. Retouched, retaken. Certain wipes and inserts will have to be made in the picture. Certain telltale abrasions in the emulsion will have to be corrected. Dissolves in the sequence discreetly combined with the trimming out of unwanted, embarrassing footage. And definite guarantees obtained. Yes, someday, before death, with its clapstick, closes the scene. Tonight she contented herself with the automatic ceremony of giving him what she remembered, more or less correctly, when planning the menu, as being his favorite food. Zelonia shi, a velvety green sorrel and spinach soup, containing slippery hard-boiled eggs and served with finger-burning, irresistibly soft, meat-filled or carrot-filled or cabbage-filled proshki, pir-rush-ki, thus pronounced, thus celebrated here, forever and ever. After that, she had decided there would be breadcrumb sander, sudak, with boiled potatoes, hazel hen, ryabchiki, and that special asparagus, hezuhanka, which does not produce Proust's after effect, as cookbooks say.
Marina, murmured Damon at the close of the first course.
Marina! He repeated louder.
Far from me, a location he favored, to criticize Dan's taste in white wines or the manner de vos domestiques. You know me, I'm above all that rot. I'm...
gesture.
But, my dear, he continued, switching to Russian, the Chelovek, who brought me the piroshki, the new man, the plumpish man with the eyes,
Sklazamye. Everybody has eyes, remarked Marina dryly.
Well, his look as if they were about to octopus the food he serves, but that's not the point. He pants, Marina. He suffers from some kind of odishka, shortness of breath. He should see Dr. Krolik. It's depressing.
It's a rhythmic pumping pant. It made my soup ripple.
Look, Dad, said Vaughn, Dr. Krolik can't do much because, as you know quite well, he's dead. And Marina can't tell her servants not to breathe because, as you also know, they're alive.
The Veen Wit, the Veen Wit, murmured Demon.
Exactly, said Marina. I simply refuse to do anything about it. Besides, poor Jones is not at all asthmatic, but only nervously eager to please. He's as healthy as a bull and has rode me from Ardisville to Lodore and back and enjoyed it many times this summer. You are cruel, Demon. I can't tell him ne petitia, as I can't tell Kim, the kitchen boy, not to take photographs on the sly. He's a regular snap-shooting fiend, that Kim, though otherwise an adorable, gentle, honest boy. Nor can I tell my little French maid to stop getting invitations, as she somehow succeeds in doing, to the most exclusive bal masqué in the door.
That's interesting, observed Demon.
He's a dirty old man, cried Vaughn cheerfully.
Vaughn, said Ada.
I'm a dirty young man, sighed Demon.
Tell me, Bouteillin, asked Marina, what other good white wine do we have? What can you recommend?
The butler smiled and whispered a fabulous name.
Yes, oh yes, said Demon. Ah, my dear, you should not think up dinners all by yourself. Now, about rowing. You mentioned rowing. Do you know that moi, qui vous parle, was a rowing blue in 1858?
Vaughn prefers football, but he's only a college blue, aren't you, Vaughn? I'm also better than he at tennis. Not lawn tennis, of course, a game for parsons, but court tennis, as they say in Manhattan. What else, Vaughn?
You still beat me at fencing, but I'm the better shot. That's not real Sudak, Papa, though it's tops, I assure you.
Marina, having failed to obtain the European product in time for the dinner, had chosen the nearest thing, wall-eyed pike or dory, with tartar sauce and boiled young potatoes.
Ah, said Demon, tasting Lord Byron's hock. This redeems our lady's tears. I was telling Vaughn a moment ago, he continued, raising his voice. He labored under the delusion that Marina had grown rather deaf. About your husband. My dear, he overdoes the juniper vodka stuff. He's getting, in fact, a mite fuzzy and odd. The other day, I chanced to walk through Pat Lane on the Fourth Avenue side, and there he was, coming at quite a spin in his horrid town car, that primordial petrol two-seater he's got, with the tiller. Well, he saw me from quite a distance and waved, and the whole contraption began to shake down and finally stopped half a block away. And there he sat, trying to budge it with little jerks of his haunches, you know, like a child who can't get his tricycle unstuck. And as I walked up to him, I had the definite impression that it was his mechanism that had stalled, not the hard pans.
But what Demon, in the goodness of his crooked heart, omitted to tell Marina was that the imbecile, in secret from his art advisor, Mr. A, had acquired for a few thousand dollars from a gaming friend of Demon's, and with Demon's blessings, a couple of fake Correggios, only to resell them by some unforgivable fluke to an equally imbecile collector for $500,000, which Demon considered henceforth as a loan his cousin should certainly refund him if sanity counted for something on this Gamel planet. And conversely, Marina refrained from telling Demon about the young hospital nurse Dan had been monkeying with ever since his last illness. It was, by the way, she, Busybody Bess, whom Dan had asked on a memorable occasion to help him get something nice for a half-Russian child interested in biology.
Vous me comblez, said Demon in reference to the Burgundy. Though, pravda, my maternal grandfather would have left the table rather than see me drinking red wine instead of champagne with gelinotte.
Superb, my dear, blowing a kiss through the vista of flame and silver. The roast hazel hen, or rather its new world representative locally called mountain grouse, was accompanied by preserved lingonberries, locally called mountain cranberries. An especially succulent morsel of one of those brown little fowls yielded a globule of birdshot between Damon's red tongue and strong canine. "La fève de Dion," he remarked, placing it carefully on the edge of his plate. "How is the car situation, Van?" "Vague. I ordered a Rolsey like yours, but it won't be delivered before Christmas. I tried to find a Silentium with a sidecar and could not, because of the war, though what connection exists between wars and motorcycles is a mystery. But we manage, Ada and I, we manage, we ride, we bike, we even jicker."
"I wonder," said Sly Damon, "why I'm reminded all at once of our great Canadian's lovely lines about blushing Irene. Le feu si délicat de la virginité, qui something sur son front.
All right, you can ship mine to England, provided. By the way, Damon," interrupted Marina, "where and how can I obtain the kind of old roomy limousine with an old professional chauffeur that Praskovya, for instance, has had for years?"
"Impossible, my dear. They are all in heaven or on Terra.
But what would Anna like? What would my silent love like for her birthday?
It's next Saturday. Porashotu po moemu, by my reckoning. Isn't it? Un riviere de diamant?
Protestu you," cried Marina. "Yes, I'm speaking seriosno. I object to your giving her kvaka siesva, kwa que se soit. Dan and I will take care of all that." "Besides, you'll forget," said Ada, laughing, and very deftly showed the tip of her tongue to Vaughn, who had been on the lookout for her conditional reaction to diamonds. Vaughn asked, "Provided what?"
"Provided you don't have one waiting already for you in George's garage, Ronta Road." "Ada, you'll be jickering alone soon," he continued. "I'm going to have Masco da Gama round out his vacation in Paris. Qui something sur son front en accuse la beauté."
So the trivial patter went. Who does not harbor in the darkest gulf of his mind such bright recollections? Who has not squirmed and covered his face with his hands as the dazzling past leered at him? Who, in the terror and solitude of a long night? "What was that?" exclaimed Marina, whom surtical storms terrified even more than they did the anti-Amburians of Lodore County.
"Sheet lightning," suggested Vaughn. "If you ask me," said Damon, turning on his chair to consider the billowing drapery, "I guess it was a photographer's flash. After all, we have here a famous actress and a sensational acrobat."
Ada ran to the window. From under the anxious magnolias, a white-faced boy, flanked by two gaping handmaids, stood aiming a camera at the harmless gay family group. But it was only a nocturnal mirage, not unusual in July. Nobody was taking pictures except Pirun, the unmentionable god of thunder. In expectation of the rumble, Marina started to count under her breath, as if she were praying or checking the pulse of a very sick person. One heartbeat was supposed to span 1 mile of black night between the living heart and a doomed herdsman, felled somewhere, oh, very far, on the top of a mountain. The rumble came, but sounded rather subdued. A second flash revealed the structure of the French window. Ada returned to her seat. Vaughn picked up her napkin from under her chair and, in the course of his brief plunge and descent, brushed the side of her knee with his temple. "Might I have another helping of Peterson's grouse, Tetrast bonasia windriverensis?" asked Ada loftily. Marina jangled a diminutive cowbell of bronze. Demand placed his palm on the back of Ada's hand and asked her to pass him the oddly evocative object. She did so in a staccato arc. Demand inserted his monocle and, muffling the tongue of memory, examined the bell. But it was not the one that had once stood on a bell tray in a dim room of Dr. Lapinier's chalet, was not even of Swiss make, was merely one of those sweet-sounding translations which reveal a paraphrased's crass counterfeit as soon as you look up the original. Alas, the bird had not survived the honor one had made to it, and after a brief consultation with Boutéen, a somewhat incongruous but highly palatable bit of saucisson d'Arles added itself to the young lady's fare of asperges en branche that everybody was now enjoying. It almost awed one to see the pleasure with which she and Demand distorted their shiny-lipped mouths in exactly the same way, to introduce orally from some heavenly height the voluptuous ally of the prim lily of the valley, holding the shaft with an identical bunching of the fingers, not unlike the reformed sign of the cross, for protesting against which a ridiculous little schism measuring an inch or so from thumb to index, so many Russians had been burnt by other Russians only 2 centuries earlier on the banks of the Great Lake of Slaves. Von remembered that his tutor's great friend, the learned but prudish Semyon Afanasyevich Vengerov, then a young associate professor but already a celebrated Pushkinist, 1855 to 1954, used to say that the only vulgar passage in his author's work was the cannibal joy of young gourmets tearing plump and live oysters out of their cloisters in an unfinished canto of Eugene Onegin. But then everyone has his own taste, as the British writer Richard Leonard Churchill mistranslates a trite French phrase, chacun a son goût. Twice in the course of his novel about a certain Crimean Khan, once popular with reporters and politicians, a great good man, according, of course, to the caddish and prejudiced Guillaume Montparnasse, about whose new celebrity, Ada, while dipping the reversed corolla of one hand in a bowl, was now telling Demand, who was performing the same rite in the same graceful fashion. Marina helped herself to an Albany from a crystal box of Turkish cigarettes tipped with red rose petal and passed the box on to Demand. Ada, somewhat self-consciously, lit up too. "You know quite well," said Marina, "that your father disapproves of your smoking at table."
"No, it's all right," murmured Demand.
"I had Dan in view," explained Marina heavily. "He's very prissy on that score."
"Well, and I'm not," answered Demand.
Ada and Van could not help laughing. All that was banter, not of a high order, but still banter. A moment later, however, Van remarked, "I think I'll take an Albany myself." "Please note, everybody," said Ada, "how volu that slip was. I like a smoke when I go mushrooming, but when I'm back, this horrid tease insists I smell of some romantic Turk or Albanian met in the woods."
"Well," said Demand, "Van's quite right to look after your morals."
The real profiterol, very soft L, of the Russians, as first made by their cooks in Gavana before 1700, consists of larger puffs coated with creamier chocolate than the dark and puny profit rolls served in European restaurants. Our friends had finished that rich sweetmeat flooded with chocolat au lait sauce and were ready for some fruit when Boot, followed by his father and floundering Jones, made a sensational entry. All the toilets and water pipes in the house had been suddenly seized with borborygmic convulsions. This always signified and introduced a long-distance call. Marina, who had been awaiting for several days a certain message from California in response to a torrid letter, could now hardly contain her passionate impatience and had been on the point of running to the dorophone in the hall at the first bubbling spasm when young Boot, hurried in, dragging the long green cord, visibly palpitating in a series of swells and contractions, rather like a serpent ingesting a field mouse, of the ornate brass and nacre receiver, which Marina, with a wild, "Allô!" pressed to her ear. It was, however, only fussy old Dan ringing her up to inform everybody that Miller could not make it that night after all, and would accompany him to Ardis bright and early on the following morning.
"Early, but hardly bright," observed Damon, who was now glutted with family joys and slightly annoyed he had missed the first half of a gambling night in Lador for the sake of all that well-meant but not quite first-rate food.
"We'll have coffee in the yellow drawing room," said Marina,
as sadly as if she were evoking a place of dreary exile.
"Jones, please don't walk on that phone cord. You have no idea, Damon, how I dread meeting again after all those years that dislikable Norbert von Miller, who has probably become even more arrogant and obsequious, and moreover does not realize, I'm sure, that Dan's wife is me. He's a Baltic Russian," turning to Von, "but really echt Deutsch, though his mother was born Ivanov or Romanov or something, who owned a calico factory in Finland or Denmark. I can't imagine how he got his barony. When I knew him 20 years ago, he was plain Mr. Miller."
"He is still that," said Damon dryly, "because you've got two Millers mixed up. The lawyer who works for Dan is my old friend Norman Miller of the Fainley Feller and Miller Law Firm, and physically bears a striking resemblance to Wilfrid Laurier. Norbert, on the other hand, has, I remember, a head like a kegelkugel, lives in Switzerland, knows perfectly well whom you married, and is an unmentionable blackguard."
After a quick cup of coffee and a drop of cherry liqueur, Damon got up.
"Partir, c'est mourir un peu, et mourir, c'est partir un peu trop. Do tell Dan and Norman I can give them tea and cake any time tomorrow at the Bryant. By the way, how's Lucette?"
Marina knitted her brows and shook her head, acting the fond, worried mother, though in point of fact, she bore her daughters even less affection than she had for cute Dak and pathetic Dan.
"Oh, we had quite a scare," she replied finally. "Quite a nasty scare. But now, apparently."
"Van," said his father, "be a good scout. I did not have a hat, but I did have gloves. Ask Bouteillon to look in the gallery. I may have dropped them there. No, stay, it's all right. I left them in the car, because I recall the cold of this flower, which I took from a vase in passing."
He now threw it away, discarding with it the shadow of his fugitive urge to plunge both hands in a soft bosom.
"I had hoped you'd sleep here," said Marina,
not really caring one way or another.
"What is your room number at the hotel? Not 222, by any chance?"
She liked romantic coincidences. Damon consulted the tag on his key. 221. Which was good enough, fatidically and anecdotally speaking. Naughty Ada, of course, stole a glance at Von, who tensed up the wings of his nose in a grimace that mimicked the slant of Pedro's narrow, beautiful nostrils.
"They make fun of an old woman," said Marina, not without coquetry,
and in the Russian manner kissed her guest on his inclined brow as he lifted her hand to his lips.
"You'll forgive me," she added, "for not going out on the terrace. I've grown allergic to damp and darkness. I'm sure my temperature has already gone up to 37.7 at least."
Damon tapped the barometer next to the door. It had been tapped too often to react in any intelligible way, and remained standing at 3:15. Von and Ada saw him off. The night was very warm and dripping with what Lador farmers called green rain. Damon's black sedan glinted elegantly among the varnished laurels in the moth-flaked porch light. He tenderly kissed the children, the girl on one cheek, the boy on the other, then Ada again, in the hollow of the white arm that clasped his neck. Nobody paid much attention to Marina, who waved from a tangelo-colored oriel window a spangled shawl, although all she could see was the sheen of the car's bonnet and the rain slanting in the light of its lamps. Demand pulled on his gloves and sped away with a great growl of damp gravel. "That last kiss went a little too far," remarked Van, laughing.
"Oh, well, his lips sort of slipped," laughed Ada,
and laughing, they embraced in the dark as they skirted the wing of the house. They stopped for a moment under the shelter of an indulgent tree, where many a cigar-smoking guest had stopped after dinner. Tranquilly, innocently, side by side in their separately ordained attitudes, they added a trickle and a gush to the more professional sounds of the rain in the night, and then lingered, hand in hand, in a corner of the latticed gallery, waiting for the lights in the windows to go out.
"What was faintly off-key, yet talk about the whole evening?" asked Van softly. "You noticed?" "Of course I did. And yet I adore him. I think he's quite crazy, and with no place or occupation in life, and far from happy, and philosophically irresponsible, and there is absolutely nobody like him."
"But what went wrong tonight? You were tongue-tied, and everything we said was falshiva. I wonder if some inner nose in him smelled you in me, and me in you. He tried to ask me, oh, it was not a nice family reunion. What exactly went wrong at dinner?"
My love, as if you don't know. We'll manage, perhaps, to wear our masks always, till D do us part. But we shall never be able to marry, while they're both alive. We simply can't swing it, because he's more conventional in his own way than even the law and the social lice. One can't bribe one's parents, and waiting 40, 50 years for them to die is too horrible to imagine. I mean, the mere thought of anybody waiting for such a thing is not in our nature, is mean and monstrous.
He kissed her half-closed lips, gently and morally, as they defined moments of depth to distinguish them from the despair of passion. "Anyway," he said, "it's fun to be two secret agents in an alien country. Marina has gone upstairs. Your hair is wet."
"Spies from Terra? You believe? You believe in the existence of Terra?"
"Oh, you do. You accept it. I know you." "I accept it as a state of mind. That's not quite the same thing."
"Yes, but you want to prove it is the same thing."
He brushed her lips with another religious kiss. Its edge, however, was beginning to catch fire. "One of these days," he said, "I will ask you for a repeat performance. You will sit as you did 4 years ago, at the same table, in the same light, drawing the same flower, and I shall go through the same scene with such joy, such pride, such, I don't know, gratitude. Look, all the windows are dark now. I, too, can translate when I simply have to. Listen to this." Lights in the rooms were going out, breathed fragrantly the rose. We sat together in the shade of a wide-branched berjose.
"Yes, birch is what leaves the translator in the lurch, doesn't it? That's a terrible little poem by Konstantin Romanov, right? Just elected president of the Lykaskan Academy of Literature, right? Wretched poet and happy husband. Happy husband."
"You know," said Van, "I really think you should wear something underneath on formal occasions."
"Your hands are cold."
"Why formal? You said yourself it was a family affair." "Even so, you were in peril whenever you bent or sprawled."
"I never sprawl."
"I'm quite sure it's not hygienic, or perhaps it's a kind of jealousy on my part. Memoirs of a happy chair." "Oh, my darling."
"At least,
whispered Ada.
It pays off now, doesn't it? Croquet room?
Oh, comme ça.
Comme ça, for once, said Vaughn.